ASMR Christy makes a G&T.
It's fine, it's fine, everything's fine. There will be blood. Run for your life. Go on and say, go on and say your last goodbye. There will be blood. You're gonna die. You'll never make it, never make it through the night.
Hello and welcome to the third episode of Drawing Blood, our podcast about visual culture, history of science and medicine, and the macabre. I'm Emma Merkling.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And in this episode, we'll be talking about the American pop artist Andy Warhol, born 1928 and died 1987. And we'll be talking mostly about his works from the early 1960s, starting with his painting Before and After from 1961. There's a few versions of this painting, actually, but we'll be clear about which ones we're talking about when we talk about them.
Yeah, so that painting, Before and After, is the focal image of this episode, and that is really where our various discussions all stem from. And I am super excited to be doing an episode on this because I am obsessed with plastic surgery, mostly for, like, professional research reasons, but also just I have such a morbid fascination around it.
So, yeah, I mean, basically, because we'll be talking about surgery and cutting into and resculpting bodies, there is obviously a content warning for descriptions of operations, but we'd also like to give content warnings for diet language and for racist language and sort of a general discussion of racism. All right, so Christy, do you want to get started?
Okay, so we'll make it easy at first and just talk about one of the Andy Warhol before and after images, because there are actually four versions of it. I think just easiest to start with version number one. Before and after, brackets, one from 1961. So this version, this painting, is in the Met. And yeah, it's an Andy Warhol painting from 1961. So since I'm bringing it in today, Emma, do you want to go ahead and do visual analysis thing?
Sure. So what we're looking at is a doubled image mm-hmm. on, it's both sort of a woman's face. It kind of reminds me of that picture where you can see half a witch and half a young girl.
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah.
Which we should link to.
Yeah.
And here it's almost as if that's been split into two. So on the left, you have this woman with a big hooked nose, these really sort of arching eyebrows. I think her I can't tell if her forehead's curving out a little bit or if it's an effect of the nose.
Mm.
And then on the right, you have a much sort of conventionally, like, quote-unquote, prettier looking woman. She has, like, this, like, cute little slope-perfect nose. Her eyes are sort of a little, maybe a little bit more open. The ratio sort of looks very, like, classic 1950s housewife.
Yeah.
You know, she has this almost, like, perfectly made-up lips. And it's, did I say it's black and white? It looks like maybe a print or a painting. I can't quite tell.
Yeah.
But it's quite stylized. Like, it's almost like a cartoon.
And it's a little bit ambiguous, like you said, in terms of medium, because you've got a little bit of drippage coming down. But, I mean, besides that, it looks like something out of a newspaper or a print or a cartoon.
Yeah.
Like something printed. But it's the slight drips that make you, you know, that tune you into the fact that it's been. Actually, I did want to say that the way that you described it is really interesting because the difference between these two faces, because in the sources that you look at about this image, the adjectives that come up a lot are that the face of the left is witch-like and the face of the right is cute.
Yeah.
So, and you used both of those.
Yeah, because it's like crone-like. I mean, and I say that because it's how witches in pop culture, like, it's like the imagery that, I'm sure we'll talk about pop culture, but, you know, it's like the imagery we're surrounded with. And I brought up 1950s housewife because it's also that, like, Vogue, golden age advertising. I don't know if that's the golden age of advertising, but, you know, in my head, like, Mad Men, you know.
And both of these ideas that we're playing with here, witch-like and cute, are both very socially constructed tropes. You know, they're not inherent in either of these facial types. It's just like we are playing off of the images that we've been given that have been happening for generations, basically.
And I think it's especially interesting that you can get that from an image that has such a paucity of means.
There's so little.
And that's sort of why I said cartoon. I don't think I mentioned this, but it's black and white. There's no shading. And that's why it also looks like a print. It almost looks like a potato print. Like, you could make this at home, you know, like, or woodblock. Like, there's blank space for the skin, for the white, and sort of patchy black, but, like, a dark, deep, solid black for everything else.
Yeah. And so one of the reasons that it might also feel like it's a print is because you have a hint of this word on the top. Yeah, it
says haped.
Yeah. So this image, classic Andy Warhol, isn't of his own making. You know, he's appropriating something. And it's actually an advertisement from the back of a like a newspaper. Not like a nice, glossy advert, like a kind of shitty classified ad.
It's one image. Yeah.
And they are from an advert from the back of the National Enquirer. So like it.
Which is what?
So the National Enquirer is basically the worst publication in America. Like today it still exists. They report on like weird celebrities that you've never heard of, about people who say that aliens have landed in their backyard.
I don't know. It sounds like something I would subscribe to.
Anyway, historically, I don't know what it was like in 1961, but that's the kind of vibe that I get from it, you know, living in the 21st century. And so it was an ad in the back of National Enquirer from 1961.
Oh, so this is the ad you're showing me now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, interesting. And it says, noses reshaped. So that was the haped that I was reading.
Yes, exactly.
Facelifting dash skin planing.
Mm-hmm.
Outstanding ears, lips, loose skin, wrinkles, eyelids, large, small breasts, acne pits and moles, etc. Corrected by plastic surgery. Consultation and information free.
Dr. C.K. Davis, 55 East 65th Street.
Ooh, Park Avenue.
Mm. So this is the kind of sense that you get of the pages that he's pulling these things from. Because like, Andy Warhol was really into all levels of popular culture, you know, and this is kind of the very fleeting, ephemeral dregs of pop culture.
So where is this happening in his career? Because obviously the images of his that we all know about are, you know, soup can, Marilyn Monroe. Yeah. And this looks quite different. I mean, I can see the continuity, but it's very different. It's not got that bright
pop art sensibility
or look. And it's like not, there's repetition obviously, but it's not repeated multiple times like his famous images. So yeah.
But you can see it kind of leaning that way.
Definitely. Yeah.
So this is at a really important part in Andy Warhol's career. And the writer Arthur Danto makes this really compelling argument for how this image actually is kind of representative of his shift from 1959 to 1961.
Okay.
Where Andy Warhol really steps into, as you said, the pop art sensibility, the, you know, the repetition, the clean lines, the taking of pop culture, the soup cans, the Coke cans, all of that. So this piece, I said earlier, is number one, but I'm also going to show you numbers two and four.
Okay.
Which he did the same year and also in 1962 as well. You know, so he's very much working on these roughly around the same time. And you can see in the shift from before and after number one to two and four, kind of a sharpening
Of
the aesthetic that we would call pop art.
So it gets less, you know, I said potato print. It's not potato print anymore. No. It's like lino cut.
Mm-hmm.
Like sharp, like you said, sharp lines. It's the exact same, you know what? It's not the exact same image. And it's interesting that it's not.
Plays with your brain a little bit.
Yeah. It's, these two faces are actually a lot more similar, I would say, than the last two.
In number four.
In the new, in the more recent image you're showing.
The most recent.
Number four, There's more similarity, which makes you notice the nose more vividly or more specifically.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, in this image, the nose is the only thing that's different.
Yes.
And
the lips are just as full, the eyes are just as girly. And
oh, actually, maybe the nose. Well, it's not just the shape of the nose, but it's also the, like,
what are you talking
this
about?
Nasolabial.
Not philtrum. Okay, so now that we're looking at it again, because was...
Eyes a little thicker.
Yeah, like, I was definitely on your page. Yeah. Like, they're exactly the same. And now that I'm looking at number four again, I'm like, okay, maybe the woman to the left with the hooked nose has more kind of under eye dark circle. And maybe her hairline is also a bit further back. You know, just maybe those slight just hints at the slightly less conventionally attractive elements.
And what it does to your eye as you look at it is you see the face seems to morph.
Yeah.
Because your eye looks from left to right and the nose seems to sort of like literally contract and like smoothen, which makes, I think, probably it's such a compelling before and after image in the first place for this advert that it was a part of.
Absolutely. I mean, I definitely want to talk about this later, like the actual advertising and medical work that this kind of image does in this period and even today. But going back to kind of this shift in Andy Warhol's career, just to say that, like, going from number one to two and four of the before and after image, like, you really, really get this move from something that looks a little bit more painterly with those drips, so that might be associated more with abstract expressionism, which was, you know, the major movement basically right before pop art in the States, headed up by people like Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner, and where it was all about physical paint and what paint does on canvas.
Yeah, and some of those drips, I mean, you see the Pollock lineage.
Yeah, absolutely. And then Andy Warhol is like, huh, maybe, okay, so with number two, I'm going to move a little bit further away from that. You can't see drips. You can see Bende dots, which are those little dots from
the printmaking process
and from comics that Roy Lichtenstein was really known for using. So you can see him playing with that lineage a little bit because he was working around the same time as Lichtenstein. And then he gets to full Andy Warhol, clean pop lines. And there's actually this story around this time when he was making these images. Warhol also made two versions of his Coke bottle images and showed his friend, who I think was named Emil D'Antonio, these two paintings, and was like, which ones do you like? And basically he took his friend's advice, because the friend was like, screw that one that has visible paint on it. This really stark, looks like an advert, never seen anything like it. Just show that one, throw the other one away. And he kind of just ran with that.
But there's also the whole, as I remember being taught Andy Warhol, there's also sort of the whole narrative about, you know, he was quite young when abstract expressionism was a thing, and he wasn't ever really sort of accepted by those artists. And I think that there's also a choosing to move, letting it go, you know, like a choosing to move away from that for whatever reason, you know, away from sort of drip paint. And
I also think that with Warhol, there's this really kind of compelling undertone of self-consciousness that we'll definitely get into, relates to plastic surgery, relates to his image. And, you know, he's known to people today as this, like, incredibly bold, like, icon, you know, really important guy, must have had his shit together, must have known what he was doing. But there is that element of not being so sure, being self-conscious, that you get with this image and with others in this period, I think. Also, in terms of, like, where this is coming from in his career, this image came out of his work before this, and the reason that it's based in advertising is because he was working, doing images for Bonwit Teller, which was a really fancy department store in New York City around this time. And there's this amazing image that we'll definitely link to in the show notes of, I think it's four or five of Andy Warhol's paintings in the window behind mannequins.
I've seen this picture.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
And so, you know, this department store was known for having artists work on its windows, like Dali and Jasper Johns also did it. But basically the concerns of that window, like commercialism, advertising, those concerns, you can almost trace them throughout everything else in his career and in this image.
I was going to say, it's not shocking to me. I mean, okay, even if Dali and these other people also had their art there, it's not shocking to me that Warhol has a sort of origin story in this department store, because all of his art from, I don't know about from this point onwards, but all of his art I'm familiar with is in some way about sort of the capitalistic American consumeristic environment that he was living in the 1960s. And I almost said 1860s and I didn't.
and it is, like you said, consumerism, but it's also about the American cult of self-improvement.
Yeah.
Like, you can be better, you can have more, you
if
can...
If you
buy surgery, clothes, whatever. And so an early version of this image, of this advert, of this painting, was in that window.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting, not only can you trace the concerns of his career in that window setup, you can also trace his specific physical insecurities in that window. Well, we can get into his biography a bit. But basically his main insecurities were his nose, which obviously you see in this image before and after, his skin. He was always said bad complexion. He said, like, if someone asked him, what's your problem, Andy? Like, what's the root of all your ills? Basically, he'd say, my skin.
Relatable.
Yeah. So, you know, if we're thinking about plastic surgery and surface and all that, he was also really self-conscious about his hair, which obviously department store mannequins and the beauty industry, hair is everything, as they say in Fleabag. And then also in that Bonwit Teller window, there was an image of a compilation of adverts, including one, not only one that says Pepsi Cola, but also one that says strong arm. So something about like weight gain, you know, for nice male physique. And that was also something that Andy Warhol was really concerned about. He took amphetamines that suppress his appetite so that he could stay thin. You know what I mean? Like, very much part of what he was concerned about image-wise. And that's all kind of in the Bonwit-Teller image, or Bonwit-Teller window, which is all tied up in this before and after image. You see what I mean?
I think it's also helpful. The picture is, you know, you're looking at, there's these Barbie doll-like women, mannequins, presumably. Although it takes you a second to figure out what's sort of going on. I wonder if I'd seen this and I didn't know if it was a store window, what I would think. You know, the first time you see it. But also, you know what it kind of reminds me of? You know that picture of people waiting in, it's like documentary photography, TM, like 1930s, people waiting in a bread line. And it's like America, the greatest city in the world or whatever.
Yeah, because they are kind of, they do look like they're waiting for something, these mannequins.
So the mannequins are lined up and behind them are these huge blown up adverts, including the nose one, as well as other ones that are not.
But see, that's the thing, is they're not adverts, they're Andy Warhol paintings.
Ah, I see.
Yeah, yeah. So it's this weird, it is consumerism, but it's also art, and that's Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
Wrapped up in a bow.
And I guess what I was getting at was the weird interplay between life and art and like flatness and dimensionality and like camp and dressing up. And I mean, these women in sort of these garish costumes in front of this art is so interesting.
And it's also, where do you get your identity from? Is it the things that you buy at the department store? Is it from like this art that you create? Is it actually
Is it from the art that you consume?
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so I was talking about Andy Warhol's insecurities, and I guess it's important to go back into his biography and his background. So he was born Andrew Warhola, and so he was an immigrant, or actually his parents were immigrants from kind of the what is now the Slovakian-Ukrainian border, and they were immigrants to Pittsburgh. Catholic immigrant family. He was born there, I believe, but he changed his name to just Andy and just Warhol.
It's funny that one of the first things I thought about when I saw the image you put up to begin with is, you know, okay, so I mean, my Jewish grandma moved to the US sort of fleeing Nazi persecution in the 1930s, obviously. And, you know, she's from that sort of like central / eastern, like Poland, Hungary, Austria sort of block. And she also changed her name, like cut the man off like Perlman, you know, and like Americanized, anglicized her name. And I think when I saw that image, that's what I thought about. I mean, not only because the time is the same, like when she finally became like a naturalized citizen and all this other stuff, but because I think that that narrative and that sort of like fleeing of some sort of specter is in there. And the associations with Judaism and that noise and like caricatures about Judaism's association with that part of the world too, with sort of like, you know, you think of Yiddish, like with Eastern Europe and Central Europe. And I'm just like not shocked that he moved to the States and changed his name, even if he's not Jewish.
Yeah. Exactly. And we're definitely going to get into racialized ideas about the nose, but I think that this image and that idea, and you're talking about your own family history, which is very similar to mine. My great-grandfather came from, you know, Ukraine, and Slobogan, as shocking as it might be, is not what it actually was. That's the simplified version. But, you know, there's this idea that you can be whatever you want in America, and that ended up not really being the case. Like, you can't escape your physiognomy in a lot of senses because of the way that the society was set up, and so you had to turn to things like plastic surgery or consumerism or changing your name in order to synthesize
So changing the external to like fit in, I mean, it fits exactly with that sort of consumerist advertising.
It's like if you're perceived one way, then you are that way, which, you know, we know you might feel like a fraud on the inside, but at least everyone else doesn't think that you're a fraud.
But it's so interesting you say that, because like I feel like that's what his art is, you know, it's that thing of like what you perceive is what you get. Yeah. It's flat. That's
it. And he, oh my God, I'm glad you just said that, because he said, I think it was in the Philosophy of Andy Warhol, From A to B and Back Again. I'm not going to say that full title ever again. He actually said, you know, if you want to know who Andy Warhol is, just look at my face or at the surface of my work. It's all there.
He said surface?
Yeah. I know. Perfect. I know. So it is, once again, all about skin, all about what's on the external, or at least ostensibly. That's what it's about.
And I think it's also worth saying that the reason I said that about his pictures, and we'll link to, I don't know, like soup cans or something. I don't know what we're going to talk about, but
not that no one is. Not that
I mean, yeah, I think of all the topics we talk about, this is probably the one that people have the most of, like, an image in their head. Exactly. But no, it's that complete reduction of the visual means of the painting to like surface two colors, maybe three colors, maybe four colors.
Yeah,
and even the screen printing process, which is this sort of thin once-off layering. You know, you like pull the squeegee, like it's one go. It's not
reproducible.
Like, it's reproducible, and often in his pictures, because there's like four images or whatever, that reproduction's really, attention is really drawn to that reproduction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why it's interesting. And that's why maybe this before and after image throws you off a bit, because it's not exactly the same thing twice.
Yeah.
Which is what we're used to with Andy Warhol. Or, you know, we're used to two images of Elvis and one is slightly different colors than the other.
Yeah.
Or two images of Mao or whatever. But, you know, so it is all about image. And, you know, Andy Warhol's personal image was very much a brand, as you would say, Andy Warhol TM.
is that my brand? Putting TM on all of everything?
Emma,
that's
Markling,
my brand TM. I don't even know where I picked that up.
Who knows? Also, one other thing that I want to say about Andy Warhol and image and like this cult of American self-improvement, which the history of plastic surgery definitely plays into.
I want to talk about plastic
surgery. Oh, yeah. We will. Andy Warhol also admits that he's like the most jealous person in the world. He's like, oh, which is relatable. He's like, oh, if someone orders something that looks nicer than mine, I'm in a fit of jealousy. If someone does something that I didn't want to do 5 seconds ago, I'm in a fit of jealousy. So, you know, it's always about wanting something that someone else has.
And also, I mean, with the wig and a lot of other stuff, and, you know, partly because it reminds me a lot of the dandies I'm more familiar with, like Oscar Wilde and Aubrey Beardsley, and like a Whistler, you know, that there's this sort of self-conscious fashioning of artifice.
Yeah.
I mean, you say surface, you know, this like, and it makes me think a lot about Susan Sontag on Camp, right?
Okay.
You know, that this privileging of artifice and this prioritizing of sort of artifice and art and the performative and, like you said, surface.
Yeah, and it's actually really interesting that you brought up camp, because he also has this this idea about like drag queens and artifice that they're putting on, and he just acknowledges how much work that is. He's like, I respect them because it is so much work to be something that you're not, and you can kind of that makes me a little bit sad actually, like because obviously he's doing.
I think Warhol's a very like sad clown.
Yeah, I think so too.
You know,
and so he acknowledged, he's like, damn, that's a lot of work to be a camp drag queen or to be something that you're not, and I respect it. I mean, then he's got some like probably self-hating homophobic stuff in there as well, but we'll focus on the
I also wanted to say, I mean, you know, one of the reasons I do remember reading or hearing in my undergrad that, you know, even among the other queer artists that were in his circles at the time, like Twombly, you know, all the second gen, like New York school people, that they didn't want to be associated with Warhol because he was too camp.
Yeah. And there is a lot about like him wanting to be accepted.
Yeah. I think at least in the story, I've always sort of, the narrative I've been told about him, like his self-identity is very much fashioned in like wanting to fit in.
Yeah, absolutely. And wanting to be, okay, so there's this tying exactly what you're saying to back to the before and after image. Arthur Danto, who wrote a book about Warhol, said, you know, between this 1959 and 1961, when this image was painted, Danto says he was transformed from a highly successful commercial artist, so doing those, you know, those windows, those advertisement-like images, into a member of the New York avant-garde. Quote, something he lusted after with all the passion of Miss Big Nose, yearning for the look of Miss Tiny Turned Up Nose.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you could think of this painting as a metaphor for him fitting in, becoming what he wanted to be, blah, blah, blah.
So then what do we do with increasing stylization? Just that it's becoming even more sort of refined and like artificial and...
Or it's some, to me, it's almost something like it wasn't enough. So he's got to do
almost compulsive.
More. Well, yeah. And it's like all those things that we see on shows like Botched or, you know, even on like Selling Sunset. It's never enough to just get one facelift and one boob job. Once you start, you can't. Really. I mean,
it's plastic surgery, but it's also just capitalism, right?
Yes.
Like, and it's just consumer culture.
And that's
like,
why, you know, this advert in the back of the National Enquirer is the perfect merging of those two things.
Yeah.
And actually, Warhol himself did get plastic surgery on his nose. He did it in, I think, in 1957. And he was super disappointed with the results, which is also interesting that he's painting it into this image 4 years later.
Yeah.
But basically, he had some form of rosacea, I think, on his nose. And so when he was a little kid, he used to get made fun of and called Andy the Red-Nosed Warhola.
It's not very funny.
I know. It's not like, it's not like the harder. Snappiest yeah. insult. I'm picturing them singing it to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer okay. or something, but it doesn't roll off the tongue. But so he was really self-conscious about his nose, as I said earlier. And so he went and got dermabrasion. So today people get microdermabrasion, which is a much less invasive kind of thing. It's basically sanding down. And that was what was in the original advert, right? It said, it said skin planing, which is kind of the same idea. And so he got his nose sanded down, basically. And he was super disappointed. He said, oh, my pores are even bigger. It was so painful. I can't believe I did this. But and yet he still says that he vehemently believes in plastic surgery and, you know, the right of people to do that and improve themselves and become something new.
It's also really interesting to me that we're talking about surface and skin.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's like the relationship between his obsession with the surface and then all of the stuff about the color of his skin and like sanding down the surface of his skin. I mean, it's like literally, it's all like, okay, rhinoplasty is different, but like that sort of dealing with the skin, that's like literally the most surface area of the body.
Okay. And is it weird if I say that it's almost like in the three versions that we're showing of before and after, it almost is like he's sanding it down?
Yes, because it loses that like pockmarked.
Yes!
Especially in the background. You know, no, but it like it loses some of its grittiness. It loses its texture and it's being smoothed.
Yeah, so it's almost like he's performing a dermabrasion on this image as he goes through it. It becomes clearer and yeah.
We figured it out. No one has to write about this ever again.
No. This is done. So let's continue.
Anyway,
more. So it's really interesting in terms of his biography, like that he did get his nose, not a rhinoplasty, as he said, which, by the way, a rhinoplasty is a nose job. It's not like he got that, but he did get that plastic surgery on his nose, the dermabrasion. What I find really interesting, too, my historic baby is the history of plastic surgery, more so reconstructive surgery than cosmetic surgery, but the fact that Andy Warhol is doing this painting is really interesting to me from like a niche interest perspective, because I write a lot about the weird overlaps between art and plastic surgery. A lot of plastic surgeons have a weird ego about themselves being artists.
That's so interesting.
And like their surgeries actually being pieces of art. But like I interviewed this plastic surgeon who like published a big textbook in 1980. So he's one of the ones that's like still around that I can ask about 20th century plastic surgery. And he made this joke about how he was at the Chelsea Arts Club with one of his clients and she had a piece up on the wall. And he was like, well, you know, I should nail you to the wall because you're my... Yeah.
Ew.
So that's kind of the vibe.
That's the vibe. Very Pygmalion.
Yes. Oh, and they use that myth a lot.
Do they actually?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a bit... Well, it's a bit fucked because it's like, well, the person's already alive.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. The Pygmalion myth being that there's this guy and he makes a sculpture of maybe Venus, or am I just conflating that with
or
Burne Jones?
A nice...
Whatever. Yeah, there's this guy. There's this guy, Pygmalion, and he makes a sculpture and it gets brought to life.
Yeah. And he falls in love.
And he falls in love with it.
Yeah. Exactly. But it's real people. They're just making their faces different.
Yeah, they're not like stone that's like being turned into living flesh. It's living flesh turned slightly
back
modified.
Into... Yeah.
Yeah.
And so like there's a plastic surgery textbook called Sculpture in the Living, and like there's so many articles and books called The Art of Plastic Surgery. You know, it's like a very well-worn trope. And I just wanted to go over this one quote from Harold Gillies, who's like the most famous plastic surgeon in Britain in the 20th century, and worldwide he trained a lot of Americans. So very possibly the guy who's advertising in the back of the National Enquirer. Mm. Like it's very possible that he's in a direct lineage with this guy, Harold Gillies. And so in 1934, Gillies said, a lot of these people who have plastic surgery or reconstructive surgery or aesthetic surgery done to them, quote, bearing the unmistakable stamp of the hand that molded them. It's possible to say, oh, that one is so-and-so's nose, that's another's lips, and there goes a typical so-and-so's eyelid. So connoisseurship.
That's what I was about to say. I was like, connoisseurship, but also Bertillon and like Francis Galton and sort of the cataloging of body parts.
Yeah.
Like so-and-so's nose, so-and-so's ear.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know we're going to get into race, but I just want to say, like, yeah.
Flag it here.
Flag it, but also connoisseurship. I mean, you know, the quote-unquote science of connoisseurship, which is an art historical trope that develops, I think, in the late 19th century,
mm-hmm.
Whereby there's this idea that you can tell the artist of a work of art by things like specifically the ear.
Yeah.
That's the one I remember. I don't know if it's the lips, you know, that you can tell if something's a fraud or not because you can always tell the ear of a Rembrandt
and,
or whatever.
And that's the kind of conversation, like, for non-art historians, might remember the whole conversation about that Leonardo da Vinci piece that was found 3 years ago. There was this whole debate about whether or not it was Leonardo. And so part of that was, like, the connoisseurship of, like, oh, this is his brushstroke, or this is how he would have done that hand or that eye, et cetera.
And connoisseurship is, like, largely not debunked, but,
yeah.
like, it's very, very passé. Like,
yeah,
it's
it
not
kinda,
a...
Yeah,
yeah.
Is, yeah. But okay, there's okay, one more bit to this Gillies quotation, which is even more so than, you know, that so-and-so's nose, that so-and-so's lips. He even says, quote, the same habit of style that in an artist enables the expert to say that a certain picture is of a Rembrandt or a Constable,
oh my God.
is at work in the plastic surgeon's makeup, and his results tend to run to type. There is even a certain element of impressionism that is justifiable, and there is also, unfortunately, in our poor results, an element of cubism.
Can you imagine waking up from, I don't know if you get put under, waking up from a plastic surgery, and the surgeon's like, I'm so pleased. You look just like a Manet.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, what the fuck?
If someone said I looked like a Renoir, I'd be like, take it back! No. Yeah. Anyway, I just find that super interesting, and that's a really strong undercurrent in the history of plastic surgery. It is art, or at least the plastic surgeons think it is. So, you know, they used a lot of images to illustrate their wares, to illustrate their product, and Andy Warhol is picking up on that kind of visual language in this painting. But what you said about, like, particular body parts being characterized, ears, lips, noses.
Yeah, so I think it's just that there's such a lineage for me, and it's partly because of what I study and what I specialize in, between the sort of scientific racism of the late 19th century
mm-hmm.
that's happening at the same time as the rise of connoisseurship as a discipline. And it's partly because of this visual comparison. So,
yeah, a huge interest in visually comparing things and, like, using... I mean, we talked about this in our last two episodes, like, using the visual as proof.
But if I pull up this picture... We have this image that I think is from Giovanni Morelli, who's one of these, like, early connoisseurship figures. And it's got all these different ears and, you know, one says, okay, this is by, like... Fra Filippo, and this one's by Mantegna, and this one's by Bellini. So it's what we were talking about with being able to look at the ear and immediately categorize it.
And those are all, like, Renaissance artists.
Yes. And then if you look at this photograph, this sort of, it's like a, it's almost like Andy Warhol painting.
I was just about to say that!
But, you know, you have, like, what a grid of different ears. And it's by, what's his first name? Alphonse. Bertillon. And... It's basically, the history behind this is that in the sort of latter 19th century, a bunch of scientists, Bertillon in France, and then I think later Francis Galton in Britain, are really obsessed with this idea that you can spot a criminal before they commit a crime. And the way they decide that you're going to be able to do this is by cataloging, collecting all of these photographs of different body parts or sometimes the whole face of criminals. And then Bertillon and Galton go about different ways of doing this, but then compiling those so that you can get the ear of a criminal. And, like, it has its roots in the science of phrenology, which was really sort of had its heyday between 1820 and 1850.
Pseudoscience.
And then later sort of, like, racial, anthropological physiognomy. But this idea that race or class or things like criminal characteristics, you know, your morality, are essential physical characteristics that can be read. So if we can only catalog them, you know, and if we can only have a database where we can finally read them.
Well, I mean, so anyone who's interested in this, a new book has just come out by Courtney Thompson, who's a brilliant historian, called An Organ of Murder. And it is about the American context of this, of criminality and phrenology.
Yeah, because I've just mentioned sort of France and Britain.
Yeah. So it's interesting to have, this was going on in, you know, lots of different Western countries.
Yeah, but it's this imagery and the relationship between this quote-unquote scientific or sort of history of criminology imagery, this anthropological imagery, and not only connoisseurship and sort of the cataloging of Bellini and Mantegna, and as you said, these Renaissance artists, but also how that lineage moves along to Warhol.
Yeah.
Why were we talking about this? How did we get into it?
Well, first of all, I think that doesn't matter in terms of thinking about how this grid reminds us of Warhol, because I love that visual echo. We'll definitely link to this ear image. So first of all, we were talking about plastic surgeons thinking that certain nose or lips had, you know, the artist's mark, and then linking that to the noses in Andy Warhol's before and after.
Right. So that's what I wanted to say, and that's why I mentioned sort of Judaism earlier, is that there's this typology, typecasting of certain features as connoting certain characteristics.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of us are, and just to add, this has a direct lineage to Nazism in sort of World War II and sort of latter forms of scientific and scientifically based racism and eugenics in the 20th century. But some of these tropes we're still familiar with. I mean, it's like everyone knows that Jews have big noses, like that kind of thing. But that spread sort of popularly throughout a lot of science in the 19th century. And there's another image I want to link to. You know, there's the fact that these physical characteristics were used to justify the essential and immutable and unchanging moral values that people ascribe to different classes, races, and ethnicities. And so to sort of show how that changes over time, which in turn proves that it's cultural,
it does,
there's this
yeah.
incredible image of... We're going to link to this image that's from the 19th century that sort of shows the difference between three racial types, i.e. the Irish-Iberian, meaning Irish, the Anglo-Teutonic, and the Negro. And I say that with all the scare quotes.
And also, this is not the only image like that. Like,
no.
These are rife. Every word like that.
Right.
You know, they're everywhere.
But, and just to underscore that, what the drawing in this, what, like, the features in this image are doing is drawing a parallel between the Irish face and the black person's face to show how, in fact, actually, you know, black people and Irish people are alike. And using that to sort of justify the racism against, at the time, you know, Irish people as well as black people. And the, the caption on this literally says the high type and the low type. So, like, the high type are Brits. And it's like, no offense, have you ever seen a British man who looks like this?
No.
Like, come on.
No. Yeah, so really interesting that you brought up Irish racism, because so the image that I showed you of Andy Warhol's piece before and after, that kind of quote-unquote cute nose was known as, so it's called the pug or upturned nose, right? And it's also known as the Irish nose. So in the 19th century, the Irish nose, the quote-unquote Irish nose, once again, half of the words that we're saying have scare quotes around them. But
yeah. Well, just, you know, just like imagine big scare quotes around everything in this whole episode.
But so the quote-unquote Irish nose in the 19th century was what was seen as needing to be corrected by plastic surgeons. But then by the 1940s, that's what a lot of people wanted. This brilliant historian, Sandra Gilman, talks a lot about the nose as the locus of passing. So the nose is what would allow people to pass as normative, right? So white, Anglo-Saxon,
yeah.
Waspy, whatever. And so the Irish nose became the marker for that, especially for Jews in the 1940s in America.
Yeah.
There was a huge uptick in rhinoplasties or nose jobs in the 1940s.
And it's also, I think, one of the things this picture draws out, and I think it lends itself to this discussion we're having about constructing beauty too, but, like, it's worth underscoring that whiteness is constructed
absolutely
too, right? And, you know, this, like, perfect nose that's being depicted in this picture, the high forehead, like, all this other stuff, as the sort of history of plastic surgery tells us, I mean, not just the history of plastic surgery, but also the history of art, the history of science, like, all this other stuff, it's all constructed.
It's,
like,
not real.
No, but the myth is that whiteness is neutral.
Yeah. Yeah,
white,
exactly.
And blackness
and it's ideal.
Is, you know, pigmented. Like,
and
it's there. It's added. It's additional. It's not the surface. It's an addition.
And I think that this image that you've shown us from the 19th century also links to this idea that whiteness links to classicism, links to Greco-Roman, which links to those beautiful, white, perfect Greco-Roman busts that in reality were colored.
Right, and there was a huge debate about that actually in the 19th century, and, like, people tried to suppress it. Like, it's this whole narrative.
Like, those sculptures, that, you know, pinnacle of whiteness and white accomplishment in art and in culture and in science and everything,
secretly, secretly tacky as fuck. Like,
secretly tacky.
Warhol would have loved them.
He would have loved
them.
They're,
like, painted lips, like, you know, this beautiful,
absolutely. You know, in the 1960s, that was also when there was a huge, you know, there were a lot of people looking for nose jobs, and over half of those looking for nose jobs in America in the 1960s, first or second generation American Jews.
Well, I was also about to say, you know, Eastern European is a racial type.
Oh, yeah.
Too,
yeah.
You know, that like, you know, because I initially, because of my own family history, I just immediately thought of Judaism. But like, it's not like, as the Warhol case shows, like, it's not just Judaism. It's sort of the Eastern European type.
He had issues with his nose. He had issues with his background. You know, because he also equated his immigrant background to poverty, which had its own taboos wrapped up in it, etc.
I was about to ask such a big question that I really want to get into, but I have no thoughts, just vibes.
Okay, ask it, we can cut it.
Yeah. I know, that's what I was thinking. But I was like, what is the relationship of this to capitalism? Do you know what I mean? And like, what is it about capitalism that drives us to change? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, what am I getting at?
It's making up things that actually don't, it's socially constructing things that don't matter, like your surface appearance, your, you know, these socially constructed race, et cetera, whiteness, that lead into the creation of fields like plastic surgery that then lead people to spend money.
Yeah, I guess, So I guess, you know, what is the relationship to capitalism? I mean, I guess it's like, it's related to this idea of always needing to create reasons for people to consume more and buy more and
self-improve.
And not be happy with what they have, what there is, or what they can make themselves, or what they are given themselves, or their lot. I mean, and this is very, it's also very like American dream, right? That like anyone can just change, like if you just work hard and you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you can like become whatever you want to be, which is like
to get a nose job.
Right. Which is just like palpably false.
And I'm so glad that you brought up this idea of happiness, because I want to talk about the trope of the before and after photograph.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So there's another great historian of plastic surgery. All my best book friends, basically. And her name is Elizabeth Haken. And she wrote this book with the best title called Venus Envy, A History of Cosmetic Surgery. And she talks about the link between happiness and plastic surgery that was really driven home by these American plastic surgeons who, incidentally, in the late 19th and early to mid 20th century, were really trying to give themselves credibility. Plastic surgeons were oftentimes thought of charlatans in this period.
Mm.
I mean, a little bit earlier than 1960, but also in the mid-century. You know, they, especially the ones who worked on cosmetic things, were thought of people who were using medicine and their surgical knowledge for the wrong reason.
Yeah.
So there was this idea that like, oh, if we think about the inferiority complex and unhappiness as medicalized things, then plastic surgery is a cure. And it's not just cosmetic.
Right. And I mean, I think that's also one of the things that links to the capitalism thing, as much as like, you know, this myth that the buying things will make you happy, that the constant consuming will make you happy. And the reality that we're all very much aware of in this like late capitalist world we live in, you know, like that's just, not only is that very much not the case, but I mean, I think plastic surgery is such an interesting metaphor and product and, you know, exemplar of that. Because like, I mean, I don't know how common it is like on a statistical level, but you always hear these stories about like people who are unhappy with their plastic surgery, or more that like, you know, I think you mentioned earlier, people just keep getting more plastic surgery.
Not satisfied.
Yes, exactly. That there's never enough. And that's the sort of like, what's more of a metaphor for capitalism?
And that's the great thing. That's the beauty of a before and after image, is that it totally elides all of this complications after the after. And it also totally elides the surgical difficulty and the pain between the before and the after. It just makes it this magical transformation that doesn't actually exist.
It's A to B.
It's A to B and back again, Andy Warhol. Oh, it's beautiful.
It's this idea, like, it's the reduction of time and temporality and feeling and everything into two things, into this binary, which in that first picture is echoed by the, like, what I call like the paucity of means, right? The like black and white. Like it's literally black and white.
It is literally
before
black
and after.
And
it's happily ever after, you know? It's like,
and there's this great chapter. Sorry, I keep like citing myself here. there's this great chapter in this book called Before and After Photography. And it's edited by Jordan Bear and Kate Palmer Albers. And we'll, like, link to it in the show notes and all that. But there's a chapter that talks about this temporal complication within the before and after image, that if you stop to think about it for, like, 2 seconds, there's actually an infinite number of temporalities that can grow out of this seemingly black and white narrative.
Binary.
Yeah. It makes you think, oh, God, what did that made-up person in the before and after image by Andy Warhol, what did they experience between the quote-unquote witch-like and quote-unquote cute nose?
Yeah, it's not even giving you the, like, self-improvement montage movie thing. And it's funny, like, when I was a child, I have this, like, really vivid memory of seeing in some, like, adverts or, like, a doctor's office or something, some before and after for hair, like, what's it called?
Hair,
like
hair growth.
Yeah, hair growth. Yeah. And as a child, I was like, oh, did they, like, I was like, did they accidentally switch the pictures? Mm. You know, that, like, is this actually a picture of someone losing their hair?
That's the thing, is it feels miraculous.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah, definitely miraculous. And capitalism promises that miraculousness too, right? Like, that's the language.
Quick
that's,
fix.
Yeah, and that's the language of advertising.
Yes.
It's like, if you, like, A to B, if you do this, then this. And, like, don't worry about anything else in between. This advert is 10 seconds long. That's it.
That's it. That's all you need to know. And you could be this too. Woo.
Yeah.
And the great thing about these images, and I write a lot, my own research is about, like, Second World War, plastic surgery, drawings, and photographs. And I argue that a lot of these images, you know, aren't about the patient and they aren't about the artist. They are actually showing, without showing at all, the hand of the surgeon.
But this gets back to what you were saying about surgeons seeing themselves as artists. And I think very much that idea of, like, you know, even saying, I'll pin you up against the wall. Like, you know, seeing the human being at the other end of the scalpel as, like, not human, but as malleable matter in some way that's secondary to the genius of the hand, the genius of the artist.
And that's the thing. I really think that these before and after images are not images of anything except for the genius of the surgeon.
Well, for sure. I mean, they're not even flattering. Like, even the, you know what I mean? Like, even the after images, like, I'm not talking about Warhol so much as what I'm picturing as, like, you know, the back of, like, various magazines and newspapers, but
actually in our drawing blood logo, the hands of the surgeon that are being used are actually the hands of Harold Gillies, the father of British plastic surgery, the one who I quoted saying that sometimes it looks like impressionism or cubism.
There's a cameo. There's an NFT. revelation of
we could be rich. but anyway, yeah, so before and after images I find endlessly fascinating because there's nothing there, and yet.
And also, and this is a digression that gets more into my interest than anything else, but, like, you know, the binarization of humanity and of, like, individuality and how that maps onto finance and technology and, like, mechanization and the creation of, like, binary switches and, like, World War One and, like, early computing. Like, it just maps so directly onto the history of capitalism and, like, also, like, late finance capitalism and...
Well, and it also shows you how important to these developments of these toxic structures and toxic ideas visualization is, which is, one could argue, why we're art historians.
Which is kind of the theme of this podcast.
And, I mean, I think it just underscores how important looking at these types of images and picking them apart is, because if you don't, it's harder to understand our visual world around us in 2021. You know what I mean? Like, well, it's all relevant.
Yeah, and I mean, this is very basic, like, 101 stuff, but, you know, visual literacy and learning how to read and analyze an image the way we read and analyze sources and the way that we're taught to read and analyze historical sources, English literature, you know, that everyone does in sort of their high school degree. I mean, that's sort of what we're getting at here. And, you know, even it's I think especially thinking about, like, the 19th century scientific racism and how images are used there and, like, understanding the power of images, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, I think that we're all kind of primed to dismiss Andy Warhol's images as surface and as, you know, just like a cute pop image of consumerism. When you can, like, really get into kind of darker histories, surgical histories, medical histories, racial histories.
But I do think Andy Warhol, I mean, I said sad clown, which also has its own dark side, but I mean, his crash photographs, whatever.
I was like, we're ending here. This is going to be great.
I was like, we're not ending. We're doing the crash photographs.
Okay, we've got, like, 4 possible conclusions there.
It's fine.
Yeah, let's do Crash.
I just want to talk about the movie Crash.
Okay, so Yeah, so his crashes, so his, like, Death and Disaster series.
Yeah, that, like, but then there's also sort of this iconological or iconographic reading of his work, and it's sort of repeated return to the themes of death and sort of, like, the relationship between death and consumption. I mean, yeah.
So this is also, so his Death and Disaster series, which, for those who don't know, are images of people jumping out of buildings. He's got a suicide image. He's got, you know, images of car crashes. He's got images of criminals, which relates to our conversation earlier.
Yeah.
But the Death and Disaster screen prints, the Death and Disaster series, were also the early 60s, which is when, before and after, images were, I think they were between 61 and 64.
Yeah. And I think the picture that the one that I have in my mind is his one of the Most Wanted Man series. And the reason I'm thinking of this, I think, is because we already discussed criminality and, you know, Galton and Bastian and, like, you know, these sort of repetitive, trying to catalogue the criminal. There's also really interesting class stuff here that I know we don't have time to get into, but I know I mentioned it with the racism, and I just wanted to underscore that it like, didn't just serve to prop up sort of racist tenets, but also class-based tenets, which, of course, in, like, the history of American capitalism is itself really interesting. And it's interesting that he goes to these found images of America's Most Wanted, you know.
And I love that you've brought this up, because the profile images here are exactly like the profile images in Before and After.
I know, and they're black and white. I mean, they're black and white. Like,
you can't help but draw visual connections.
Yeah. In this case, photographic, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And it's almost like, oh, is that profile like a later version? Is that after prison? Is that, I'm blabbing, but, you know.
Article on prison images is like before and after, like the temporality of
There's some weird temporality stuff going on, especially since he reverses some. He puts some of these most wanted people upside down. It's really interesting. And I think that if we tried to go more into class and race and criminality, we might be here forever.
I'm also just really realizing, like, how much I want to read about, like, contemporary theory and, like, capitalism. Because I'm like, and it's about capitalism because consumption. I'm like, no, there's more. I know there's more.
Yeah.
You know?
We know there's more. But for a podcast, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah.